Well, the world is a dumpster fire. Nothing here makes sense. And you vacillate between crippling fear and constant self-defense. And nothing's right and nothing's good. And you're paralyzed with grief. Don't kill yourself, just have a cup of coffee.
Welcome to Coffee Over Suicide, dramedy podcast about mental illness and choosing life over death, one cup of coffee at a time. I'm your host, Chris Parker Howard, and welcome to the show today. This one's going to be a little bit of a roller coaster because we have some laughs, and I choke up a few times. This one gets a little difficult, but there's some sunshine in it. And that's ultimately kind of what it all is. That's sort of how it all lands. I've been kind of up and down and sideways and whatnot. Just to give you an update, the medication is out of my system, and I'm back. I'm back on my own devices. Just carrying around the toolkit and managing this all on my own. And I say that, but you're not really ever all on your own. You never are. There's all kinds of people in your life. Even the people that you interact with short term at the grocery store, at the gas station. Those people come in. They have an impact on your life. And if you're just a little more present, you can have an impact on theirs too. It really matters the way that we treat each other and the way that we treat ourselves. The language that we use to talk to ourselves, the reality that we create for ourselves, the story we tell ourselves about who we are and our place in the world. All of those things make a big, big difference. And especially right now for me, it's huge. It's everything. Because I'm dealing with the old darkness coming back. Now, this is something I was prepared for, and it's something I'm able to deal with, but it did kind of surprise me. Now, my whole life, I've had suicidal ideation. I've been a person who suicidal thoughts come to me out of the blue, whether I want them or not. They just do. Driving down the highway, I wonder if I could flip my car if I run into that. Walking down the street, I wonder what would happen if I jumped in front of that bus. You know, things like that. And it's never really accompanied by a desire to do those things. It just comes in. It's just there. It's omnipresent. And it has been since I was 5 years old. So I didn't have that for a while when I was on the medication, which is kind of interesting. It seems strange that I would have stopped the medicine just for taking that out of my life alone. But the thing is this, you ultimately got to do what's right for you, and you got to know what's right for you. I've done a lot of years of work to know that there was a lot of stuff going on and I was not managing it. And I was honest with myself, and I knew that. But now, I'm in a new phase. And that new phase no longer needed the cast. You know, it's like you break your arm, you get a cast, you heal, you move on. It doesn't mean you might not ever need any sort of medical attention again. You're never done. You're never completely fixed. There's always something to do. And that's okay. I don't mind being a work in progress. In fact, I'm so glad that I am still a work in progress. I'm so glad that I'm not done. That there's no finish line. That I don't have to look at myself as having completely screwed it up and gotten it wrong. I'm just so glad. So glad. Now, getting back to the topic at hand, Today is a little bit of a rough one because we do get into thoughts of suicide pretty heavy. Ann Moss lost her son. He died by suicide, and we have a really in-depth conversation about what that's like from the perspective of me being a suicidal person who put my parents through all of that worry and all of that strife, and the perspective of a parent who ultimately lost their child. It's a really deep conversation. And if I tell you that we're able to have some laughs and that there are some really honest to goodness, beautiful moments in this conversation, I don't know if you'd believe it, but you got to listen to it for yourself. So I'm gonna stop talking. Here's my conversation with Ann Moss Rogers. And I can say, hi, how are you today?
Hey, I'm good, Chris. How about you?
Not too bad. You know, things are always, you know, ups and downs and whatever, but, you know, I'm here. And yeah. That's not nothing.
Yeah, that's true. Well, I just published a book 2 weeks ago about my son's suicide, and I think this is the place I can say it because I haven't really said it elsewhere.
Yeah.
But I'm kind of losing my mind some days.
Yeah.
It's been great having it out there, but there are days where I'm really struggling with the grief, and I've had a pretty epic grief relapse in the last few days. A lot of tears and Kleenex.
Well, that's a lot to go through. I mean, over and over again. I mean, the act of writing it all out and getting the book together and having that to look at once you've completed the editing and the, you know, everything, and you get it all done, it's published, it's out there, and now you've got to talk about it. And it's reliving it to some degree, I would have to imagine.
Yeah. You know, I speak a lot because I'm a public speaker, but it's kind of like I put my soul between two covers of a book, and I sent it out into the world. So it's kind of like outside me. And, you know, people are reading it, and that's great, and I'm loving the feedback, but it is definitely stirred up, you know, a lot of feelings.
Yeah, I would have to think it would. So take me back a little ways. Tell me about your son when he was born. What was that situation like? Where were you at in life when you got pregnant?
You know, my older son was 2 years old, and I was pregnant with Charles, and you know, I had that naive little family thing going, and life was good. But I did suffer from depression when I was pregnant with Charles. And I've never suffered from, like, what I would consider clinical depression before. And I had it for the entire 9 months I was pregnant with him. And I didn't know until after I said push and he was in my arms that, wow, I was really angry and sad a lot. And that was the first introduction I ever got to it. Now, I don't suffer from depression. My son did.
Yeah.
But it did give me a little bird's eye view of how tiring it is, and how over time it just, you're fighting it. It's really, and I didn't have medication, you know, and they offered it to me. I'm just like, what are you talking about?
Yeah.
I mean, you're having to deal with enough, you know, just being pregnant. You don't want to have to throw medicine on top of all that.
Yeah, and I think there was one other time when my son was struggling and I was struggling too, and I tried it then, and it wasn't effective for me. But maybe that's because it was more of a situational depression based on what was happening instead of, you know, something I was kind of born with. I don't really know. It just wasn't, you know, I gave it a go.
Yeah.
And it just didn't work very well. And what ended up working better for me was the support group.
Yeah.
The Families Anonymous support group was best thing I ever did for myself.
Yeah, because the situational depression, it doesn't really matter where it comes from. You know, the worst depression that you could have to deal with is yours. So it's right. Not helpful for someone to, you know, ask you to qualify it on a scale.
That's a good point. That's a good point. And then one other time, whenever I have general anesthesia, so when I have to undergo surgery, I always ask them to do propofol because I do much better mm-hmm. with that type of anesthesia than I do general anesthesia.
Yeah, I've heard that.
It's like 8 weeks of depression every time I've had it. And then it just goes away.
Yeah.
But those are the only times I've, you know, wrestled with depression. But it does give me an idea what it might be like.
Yeah. Know? What was his childhood like?
Oh, wow. He was bubbly, fun, popular. He was by far the funniest person I've ever met in my life.
Yeah.
He had the gift of timing, and he was a creative genius. He was. I remember times where I would have to grip the handle, the side of a chair to hold on so that I wouldn't fall over laughing. He was, and I haven't really laughed as much since because my comedian has left, you know, and I miss that. And it took me a very long time to find my laugh after loss. It really did.
So this was, how old was your son when he committed suicide?
Died by suicide?
Yes.
Never use the committed phrase because it denotes crime. And
oh, of course. I'm sorry.
No, that's been in our vocabulary for what, hundreds of years?
Yeah. Yeah, you know, you're right. I never thought about that. That's, yeah.
And it was originally a crime. And that's where committed came from.
Of course.
And we're trying to change that language to died by suicide because it is a public health issue.
Yeah.
He was 20. He was 20 years old. He had just turned 20.
So that was, I mean, that was a pretty long road to hoe for as long as he did. And now as a survivor, there's not really ever any real solid answers. I would imagine that was, I mean, that takes a toll on a family.
Oh gosh. And I'd say that a loss by suicide, and I'm not going to imply that my loss hurts more than anybody else's or that my losing a child by suicide hurts more than another parent losing their child.
Yeah.
Because losing a child hurts, period.
Yeah.
But it does come with this additional baggage that other types of deaths do not, because you feel that sense of self-blame. So it is more complex.
Yeah.
And it will more often trigger traumatic grief. And you just feel responsible and you feel guilty and you go through those coulda, woulda, shouldas for a very long time before you can find it in your own heart to forgive yourself.
Yeah.
And I have forgiven myself.
Well, and that's excellent. It's because that's not an easy thing to do. You know, the people that I've lost, it certainly took me, you know, years to get over the all of the retracing my steps, you know, where I could have made a difference, you know, a thing where that was a sign. I know it was a sign. You know, right. Hindsight is always 20/20. But what was your community experience like? Like the family and friends around you? Because the thing that I see a lot that I think is beginning to change is that people tend to not want to face it at all. They don't want to talk about it.
Yeah. I talked about it. I actually did an article about mental health that went all over the world before he died. So I had been very open on it, but it's not a topic that other people are very open about, his mental illness and addiction. But I wasn't expecting suicide at all. I had no idea my son had suffered from suicidal thoughts for many years.
Yeah.
And once he died, it was getting over the shock of it that took the longest amount of time. And he left a lot of lyrics behind. And it helped answer a lot of the why behind his suicide. And that's what I included in my book, because a lot of the themes he touched on were universal.
Yeah.
And it answered so many questions to me. But I decided to not only become a public speaker and an author on this subject, but just recently I became a Safe Talk trainer, which is an evidence-based training program that's 4 hours, and it's suicide prevention for everyone. So yeah. Anybody can take this course. And I want to get out there and get as many people in the community trained so that they'll start to talk about this subject. So you ask about after he died and the silence, which there was a lot of.
Yeah.
Nobody would let me talk about my child. And I was crushed by that. I wanted so badly to share stories about him or hear stories about him, but because of the death and because of how stigmatized it was, people just weren't reaching out. They did at first, like, you know, we had the memorial service, people came to the house was filled, it was beautiful. It was after that I would run into people that maybe weren't there.
Yeah.
And I was just cut off mid-sentence too often. So I wrote a follow-up article to the one that I had written before, and I thought, nobody will ever read this. Who would want to read this? And it went viral. And all of a sudden, I was overwhelmed with comments and emails and messages all on social media and, you know, thousands and thousands of them. And I started a blog after that called Emotionally Naked. And that's what I talk about. I talk about addiction, mental illness, suicide, grief, yeah. All those things nobody wants to talk about.
Nobody wants to talk about these things.
Right.
And I find that it is getting more and more attention. It seems like we're at a moment in history where this is starting to bubble up to the surface.
It is.
And we're just starting to have these fledgling conversations inarticulately and stumbling along, getting some facts wrong, getting some information from the wrong place, overreacting to mm-hmm. certain things. And, it's funny, too, because I imagine that a lot of the people that were having a hard time hearing you talk about it were people that loved you dearly.
Yeah. I think that there were. And then there are other people that I expected to hear from that I have never heard from. Not once since he died. And I've tried to contact them, and they've ignored them. So I will say that a loss by suicide can rewrite your address book.
Yeah, I would imagine it would. You know, people have their own fears and biases that they're tackling when you're confronted with a death in the first place. You know, the first thing that goes through everyone's mind when someone passes, and you've got to go to the funeral and or not go to the funeral. You know, you start examining your life. Everyone does it. It's something that people do. And some people are, let's say, better at processing feelings about the world and mortality and their own mortality than others.
That's true. There are people who are a lot more comfortable talking to you about it than others. I mean, I find that there are people who will talk to me, but they have this barrier and they will not allow that emotional, you know, they will not cross the emotional moat.
Yeah.
And they do not want to look vulnerable, and they are not going to go there.
Yeah.
And there's nothing I can do about that. And if they want to skate on the surface of life without dipping underneath the surface, then there's not much I can do about that.
Well, and we can all connect to pain and grief in our own way. It's something that we all experience. It's a universal experience to feel loss and pain and grief. You know, there are levels of it that catch people off guard. And it's when people don't necessarily match that we tend to get into trouble. You know, that idea of someone who is everything's going right, they have everything going their way, and they're still unhappy. It's like, well, I don't know how to process you. You're different. You're an outlier.
Right.
It's like, well, I mean, there's something else going on. And it's happening in a lot of different places. But for you to start restructuring your life after this loss, where did you start?
Oh my gosh, I was so confused for so long, and I felt this calling, and the book, you know, was writing itself in my head and was stalking me. And I owned a digital marketing company. Mm-hmm. And I thought, I'm going to rekindle that passion, and I'm going to be able to get back in there, and I'm just going to love it again. And Chris, that just never happened. So my business partner called me one day, and I had my phone in my hand with the intention of calling him. And we had discussions on what should I do going forward. But I didn't know. I didn't know what I wanted to do. But then I made the decision that I wanted to sell my partnership. I was just no longer into it. And I kept at first telling myself, you know, if I stick with this 3 more years, I could be a millionaire.
Yeah.
And then it got to the point I could give a rat's ass about being a millionaire.
Yeah.
You know, I just wanted to follow my passion of being a speaker.
Yeah.
And, you know, I'm just now starting to get paid for it, but I can't say that I'm making some glamorous living off of it yet.
Right. But you love what you're doing.
I do. And I've never looked back. I never said, oh gosh, I wish I really couldn't wait to stop. And and I remember my business partner said, well, we could work it out in the contract where you got, you know, you could work 6 more months and get paid. And I'm like, no, I'm real happy with the 30 days. Thank you. I mean, I just was ready.
Yeah. So just ready. Taking a chance on yourself.
And it was a big leap into a huge discomfort zone.
Yeah.
And I'm learning the speaking business and the publishing business, and they're both very complicated, and I don't know much about either one. I've learned a lot.
Yeah.
But they're definitely, you know, I've kind of known my market for like 30 years, and to abandon that and go into this new one. But I'm also bringing my marketing skills into suicide prevention.
You're not completely unprepared for what it is you're doing here.
No, no. And I used to be a speaker. I just, you know, I would speak on social media on steroids, and now I'm, you know, turning pain into purpose. So the titles have changed a lot. But I actually apply those marketing skills to saving lives online. Because I figured out I couldn't, well, I looked at my son's death certificate, and at the bottom it showed his instrument of death. And I thought, how did he know how to pull that together?
Yeah.
He was no engineer. I mean, he was really creative genius. He's really smart, like Mensa smart. But I'm like, you know, how did he figure this out? And then it was like, he Googled it.
Yeah.
He Googled it. And I vowed then to write headlines that I knew people plugged in to Google when they were struggling or looking for a specific way to die. Mm-hmm. And several of those rank on the first page of Google worldwide. And I get comments on those pages, "You saved my life last night." And I've got a video of my son that I made. And it's a homemade video. It doesn't look fancy, but you know what? I think that's what's important about it. It looks real.
Yeah.
You know, it looks like mom put it together. And it's 56 seconds. And it starts with, you know, I know you're hurting and I know your pain. So I'm connecting with the pain first.
Yeah.
So basically, I learned a lot from my son's rap lyrics. I learned a lot from talking with people with lived experience. And I learned a lot from a researcher I work with at National Institute of Mental Health. And a lot from my training, and put all that together and used my marketing smarts. And, you know, I was able to rank really high at the top of Google when people would plug in certain words.
So subverting their search results with help instead of the help they were looking for, the help they needed.
I'm not giving instructions. I wouldn't even know what to say. I have no idea how to, you know, he fashioned what he did. Mm-hmm. And I'm not about to give anybody those instructions. So I do have the suicide hotline and the suicide text line. And then I realized, well, there was a lot of Canadians coming to the page, and then a lot of Australians coming to the page, and then a lot of Brits were coming to the page from the UK. So I put those hotlines, and then I saw people from Kazakhstan and India and Egypt and, you know, all over. And then for that, I put a link to the suicide hotlines internationally. So Wikipedia has a list of them that they keep up to date.
Wow, yeah.
So, and I can see in the statistics where people have called the numbers or gone to the crisis text line in every single country. And even if they don't make, there's about 500 comments on the page and about 200 on YouTube, because some people search directly through YouTube, mostly the young people, and they'll find the video. And because I think it's ranked number one on the videos. So it's been really remarkable. And yeah, I'm helping them, but they're helping me too.
Yeah.
And you know, I'm only making comments. I'm not, you know, calling people.
Right.
It is through commenting, and yeah. I'm not trying to fix it because I'm not qualified to do that.
No, right, exactly. I'm in the same boat here. You know, I tell people right out of the gate, I can empathize with you, but you know, having a conversation with me versus a professional is a bit like sitting down with a good-natured dog for a little while. You know, I might make you happy for a little while, but I'm not qualified to do anything beyond that.
But you know what, Chris? That's sometimes all it takes to save a life. And
yeah, absolutely. I've had my life saved, you know, by the simplest of things. I was a suicidal teenager and a musician, and you know, I think about there was a time that the second time I was admitted into the hospital for a suicide attempt, and the look on my father's face, and the thought in my mind of all of the frustrations and everything that I had attempted to get out through poetry and song lyrics and, you know, just writing and drawing pictures and, all of this big binder of various mixed media of art, that I had left in my room thinking, you know, my folks are going to find that while I'm in here. And it's going to destroy them. And I was trying to explain, you know, this is me trying to get these things out of me. It's not really a matter of glorifying anything. It's like trying to solve an intellectual or emotional puzzle. And I feel like if I write this stuff out, maybe I'll understand it.
You know, it's funny you say that, because that's what my son did with rap lyrics. And he wrote like 40 notebooks of it.
Oh, yeah.
And I only ended up with 8, but they're genius. And it really gave me the insight. But I remember he was in a residential treatment center at one point, and they took his music away from him. Like they could rip those thoughts from his head, you know, and they got mad at him.
Yeah.
And I remember being really angry, because it's like, he's writing it out. And I didn't know what it said. They didn't share that with me. But I'm like, writing is a good thing. And by taking away his notebooks, you're not taking away those thoughts. You're taking away the medium that allows him to get it out of his head.
Yes.
And that really made me mad. But it helped me. It's such a gift now that I have those music lyrics.
Yeah.
It really is, because it's answered so many questions, and I have answers that other people don't have.
I imagine going through those, especially the darker bits, had to be difficult.
Oh, heartbreaking. And I've included them in a book, so everybody gets to be heartbroken too. But I also included some funny ones he had written.
Yeah.
And the one at the end of the book that I ended the book with is just beautiful. And it's uplifting, and it's positive, and it's one of the few he had that was in that genre.
Yeah.
And when I was deciding on the end, I was looking through this notebook, and I thought, how am I going to end this? And I opened it, and there it was. And I had never seen it or read it before. I don't know how I missed it. And I'm like, okay, this is kind of a divine intervention or something. And I'm like, thank you, Charles. But it really, I love going and reading that. And I'll be honest with you, when they've asked me to do readings, that's what I want to do, but it's the ending of my book, and I don't want to reveal it, you know. So I haven't read it, because it's a gift if you've read the whole book.
Yeah.
Because it's not an easy read.
I imagine.
But it gives people a background of traits I saw that, you know, alarmed me, things, decisions I wish I had made instead, because we have more research on it now.
Sure.
And I've had parents already get in touch with me and tell me that it's really helped, and they've kind of pulled back because they realize they can't fix it for another human being. All they can do is let that person know that no matter what, you know, they love them.
Yes. Yeah. It's really, honestly, the best thing you can hope for from anyone is to have them say, even, I don't understand what you're going through. I just want you to know that you're not going through it by yourself.
Right.
Sometimes that's enough. It can definitely get hard. It can definitely feel isolating and lonely. But the more we start talking about these things, and have it be seen that it's real people with real problems figuring out little ways to live through themselves. You know, it's very important to know that this is something that this life is something that you can live through, and it's right. Not always going to be easy, but there are other people struggling and they might have a couple of tools you could put in your tool belt.
Well, we're really not supposed to do all this alone.
No, but not at all.
When the digital age came in, that which we thought would bring us together really pushed us apart.
Yes.
And we're spending less face time with each other, and that's affecting our children in a negative way.
Yeah.
And suicide rates illustrate how it is affecting our children.
Yeah, and they're up something astonishing, like 56% among teens in the last 10 years or something?
Between 2006 and 2017, the age of 10 to 17, it is up 70%.
Oh, man.
And with African-American children in that same age range, 77%.
And that's crazy.
I've had 10-year-olds reach out to me on YouTube, 10.
Yeah.
That they want to kill themselves. And it's just shocking. And, you know, I got to be real careful with the 10-year-old because they're impulsive.
Yeah.
And the child that reached out to me a few months ago was an African-American boy, 10 years old. And I went and I looked at his videos, and he was adorable. And he's got this cute little video, and he's playing both parts. He's wearing a hat, and he's not wearing a hat. So I commented on his video, and I went back to the comment where he had, you know, asked for help. And I said, have you ever thought about a drama class? I said, you're pretty engaging, and I think you would be a big hit on stage.
Yeah.
And do you know what he did? He asked his mother to take him to a new school that had a drama program. And I don't know if he enrolled, but I haven't heard from him, and he's made no new videos. But he did come back to me and tell me how much he loved this school. He loved this program. He was in love with it the minute he saw it. And I am just hoping that he got engaged and involved in that.
Yeah.
And I think he did, because I've seen some activity on his channel, just not a lot. So
yeah.
He's spending less time online.
He's obviously busy.
He's busy.
Yeah.
You know, he is doing 10-year-old things on stage with a bunch of people.
Yeah. You know, there's nothing like creativity to really spark the joy centers of your brain. You know,
exactly.
I tell people all the time, don't worry about making something amazing. I mean, make a bunch of garbage, but like make garbage that you love.
Right.
You know, get it out there. Just put something into the world that wasn't there before you were there.
Right.
Why not? You have absolutely nothing to lose. I mean, it's yours.
Yeah. It is. And now I'm kind of putting together presentations and I'm like, you know what? Nobody's doing this online thing.
Yeah.
It's a scalable, doable thing for a number of people to be able to participate in this and help people online. And I mean, I'm asleep sometimes when I get these messages and
yeah.
I answer them, but I'm answering them hours later.
Yeah.
You know, and you know, I'm sure that many people that post on it are no longer with us. I mean, it's a Hail Mary, the last, you're getting somebody at that moment when they want to do it.
Yeah.
And can I pull them back from that? And the chances are that it hasn't worked.
Statistically, it's, you know, you can't save everyone and you can't take responsibility for saving everyone.
I can't. But the fact is, those pages have saved a lot of lives.
There's nothing wrong with trying.
No.
Nothing wrong with trying.
It works. And the first time I got a message from a really long message, and he had spent like 8 hours on the site that night, my husband and I cried a box of Kleenex. You could sit in a bathtub for all the tears I cried. And they were good tears. I was just like, oh my God, this works. And here we are 500 comments later. And, you know, not all of them are good.
Yeah.
Some of them have been angry with me, but I answer everyone with respect, because if I am suffering from suicidal ideation, I might not be the most pleasant person. I might be angry.
Yeah.
And I think they are entitled to the anger. And I tell them that. I'm not offended by your anger. You're hurting. And I can understand that when people are in pain, they're mad.
Yeah, absolutely. It's not really for us to say what someone is supposed to be feeling, how they're supposed to be talking when they're going through something emotional. The best thing you can do when someone tells you what they're going through is believe them.
And listen.
Absolutely listen.
Listen more and lecture less. Well, we love to give fix-it quick solutions and we're on our way.
And that's a hard one. It's hard when you see someone struggling not to try to just throw the fastest fix at them. It's hard to not just say, this is scary. What do I do? What do I have at my disposal? Don't do it. You have so much to live for. I don't know. There's a new TV show coming out tomorrow. Things are good in your life. Why don't you look at that? You know, maybe if I shame you into not killing yourself, you won't be so suicidal. If I tell you, you know, well, that's very selfish. You know, if we talk to you this way, but I mean, that doesn't make anybody feel any better.
It doesn't. In my suicide prevention training that I teach, you know, we teach people what the invitation sound like, because 85% of people who die by suicide say something that we know later indicates that they were thinking of suicide.
Yeah.
The word burden is often in there.
Mm-hmm.
I don't want to live anymore. I mean, we just don't take it seriously because we can't imagine that somebody's life would be so bad that they would want to leave it.
Yeah.
Because we aren't in that space when they are. And I tell people, okay, you've had this 4 hours and you may be feeling kind of overwhelmed, but you have the steps. You have the steps. And in that moment, you will be able to pull from them. And even if you don't do them perfectly well, if you connect with that individual and do the best that you can, they will sense that. If you do it all perfectly and you don't make that human connection, they will sense that. And it's more likely that they would follow through.
Yeah.
So it's that connection piece, that listening piece, that I care about you and I want to help you save your own life.
You know, it is interesting as well that you had mentioned the way that we're, excuse me, the way that we are isolating ourselves due to due to our technology. You know, it is a real catch 22 because the internet is so young and it has given us so many great, great life-changing advances. And it's taken away so many other things.
Yeah.
We haven't yet quite figured out how to manage what that's going to do.
Perfectly and I think
that,
said.
I think we are starting to discover that as human beings, there is a physical connection that is required for us to keep going. You know, they did those studies with chimpanzees where if the child was fed and cared for, you know, by a feeding tube and everything, it would die if there was no human contact, if there was no, you know, physical bond, connection in the room, mm-hmm. in the same place. Infants, the same thing. I have to believe that there's a part of us as a species that requires some level of connection to feel connected. You know, we've got to be in the same physical space at least some of the time.
Yeah.
Because you can be talking to 1,000 people on the internet and you're alone in a room.
Right. And I recognize that for myself. Yeah. And I make sure that I get out and go to events because I work at home.
Yeah.
And I make sure that I go and make those human connections. Because if I go 2 days with my office just doing work, I get really irritable. I get bummed out. I don't handle things well. So I know me, and I know I need to go make those connections. And I put them in every week.
Yeah.
You know, make sure that I have those connections where I can, you know, face to face. And I like to meet, like if I lived in Denver, I would be sitting in your studio.
Yes.
That would be my choice, is to have this one-on-one.
Of course. Yeah.
Even if I had to drive 45 minutes to an hour to get there.
Yeah.
But it's thousands of miles. So it is a little
scary. Well, I do thank you for taking the time to do this with me from all the way over there. And this has been really heartwarming to know that, you know, sometimes out of grief can come beauty.
Yeah.
Would you mind sharing with me and the listeners just one good memory of Charles?
This is one of my favorite stories. So he was, after he died, I didn't know it until this young lady told me. She said that she was going to school one day and she suffered from depression and she didn't want to go, but she made herself go. And she's standing in the hallway with a bunch of friends and they're all chatting and they don't even recognize that she's depressed. But she said it was all I could do to stand there with them. And she said she looked up and she saw Charles, my son, staring at her. And she said, Mrs. Rogers, everybody knew who Charles was, but she said, we'd never met. And he was like looking straight at me. And then all of a sudden he makes a beeline towards her and he's standing about a foot in front of her and he breaks out in a rap song he created on the spot just for her. I mean, who does that, Chris?
Yeah.
And she and her friends are just shocked at first because, again, who does this? And then they die laughing. And he finishes his song and he bends over and he gives her a hug and he said, pretty girls shouldn't look so sad. And he makes his way down the hall. And she said of all the things that anyone has ever done for her, she will never forget that moment. And she remembers it when she is struggling with a particularly rough depression episode.
Yeah.
And I think that as funny and as smart as Charles was, I think that was his greatest gift, was letting other people know that they mattered.
That's fabulous. Thanks for talking to me today.
Well, thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
And there you have it. That was really something special, and I cannot thank her enough for having this conversation with me. It really meant the world. I hope you enjoyed it as much as I did. And if you have not yet watched her TED Talk, you can find it at her website, annmossrogers.com. And it's got everything. It's got the book. It's got coaching. It's got all sorts of mental health resources. And it is phenomenal. As for me, I'm working on some music projects right now, trying to get my head back on straight. And so far, so good. Really, that's the best you can hope for, is best effort. And as always, don't kill yourselves out there.